I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, sexual abuse in the first degree, attempted murder in the second degree.
This is Alec Roberts in New York. There were more indictments today in the brutal gang rape of the 28-year-old Wall Street executive. Five teens between the ages of 15 and 17 were charged with numerous rape, sodomy, and assault counts. Pleas by their attorneys for bail were denied.
You've seen these young children come before you, Judge. You've seen what they look like. You've seen the mass hysteria that's in the paper. Perhaps that was some advantage of having them to come before you so you could actually see these children.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it. And it's more than anger, it's hatred. And I want society to hate.
Hello and welcome to I Could Murder a Podcast, Series 8, Episode number 10. I'm back with the boys who have turned into men. How you doing, Ben?
I swear. I'm doing really well, by the moon and the stars. Isn't that Boys to Men? No, that's All for One. Oh no, I've done that wrong. I'm doing very well though, doing very, very well.
Hold on a second, Ben. How you doing, Dan?
Yeah, good. How does it feel to be 55.555 recurring percent of the way through the series?
Wow. Oof.
Basically halfway. But, you know, you've got to be precise with these things.
For sure. It feels great. The series is kind of, for me, it's kind of flown by. As we said, it's been very eclectic with the mix. But Ben, back to you. How you doing?
Yeah, really well. It was All for One. I just did do a double take just so I don't look silly at the very start of the episode. But no, doing really well. We've arrived at another very different dynamic in terms of the case today. But yeah, doing really well. Had a great week so far. Long may it continue. Hope everyone else out there is having a lovely week so far or weekend. And just hang in there. It's going to be great.
And this will actually be our 99th upload onto our podcast audio sites. So this is number 99. I mean, we've got some minisodes in this. It's kind of a little bit not full main episodes. But what a number to hit. So very happy about that.
Yeah, we worked out that Series 9, Episode 1 is going to be the actual 100th official release without including any of the minisodes we've slung up. So that's pretty exciting.
It's full of stats, boys. It's riveting stuff.
And talking about numbers, today's case is the Central Park 5. So, we're back again with a new case, and it is a very different case. As we've said, this series has been very eclectic, so we're excited to get into this case. It's one that caused a lot of controversy at the time, and... But we're excited to go through it with you.
Absolutely. And we've got 8 more main channel episodes coming the rest of Series 8. So do stick with us. And if you aren't already, why not follow us on our socials at Could Murderer Pod? Because soon, in the coming probably month, we'll have the audience case vote for Episode 16. And that will likely be on there sometime in the coming weeks. So give us a follow and give us a vote. Pick the case you want to see coming. It's already been a very mixed series, hasn't it, in terms of the different ones we've covered. So we have our theories on what the audience might vote for, but we're excited to see what they come up with.
And yes, we've just actually celebrated our third birthday, 3 years doing our Kimura podcast, which is very exciting. Some thought we would never make it, me being one. And to celebrate, we're going to be slashing our prices in half over on the website. And we're going to be doing that until the 1st of September. So why not, you know, a little birthday gift to us, but gift to you back. Go over there, join the cult, get access to well over 120 cases, 125 extra minisodes over on the website, and you can join us with live streams as well.
Good old birthday slashing of prices.
Exactly.
Yeah. Happy birthday, everyone.
But Ben, enough waffle from us. Today's case, do you want to fill the guys in a little bit more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one that we've talked about for quite a while, covering on the podcast. It's a fascinating one, as Tom said. We are, of course, covering the case of the Central Park Five, also known as the When They See Us case, also known as the Central Park Jogger case, also known as the case of Corey, Kevin, Antron, Youssef and Raymond, also referred to as New York's biggest miscarriage of justice. But yeah, a very upsetting case indeed. One that, as Tom said, caused a lot of controversy at the time and still does to date. But as is the norm with this series, we're going to hand over to our wonderful producer, Dan, to set the scene.
Before we do that, who wants a riddle?
Oh my God, he's done it again.
Play that bloody jingle.
Dan's riddle, sly and mischievous grin. Twist and turn and mind games to win. Puzzles aplenty, a chuckle or two. A laughter and thought, we find our clue.
Riddles! Right, it's going to get a little bit harder now, okay, boys?
That's fair.
Specifically because it's quite hard to find true crime-related riddles. So it's going to be a bit more generic now. Two in a corner, one in a room. Zero in a house, but one in a shelter. What am I?
Ooh.
So I'll leave that tingling on your little brain cells.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to it at the end of this episode.
A bit of mind exercise there.
Yeah.
Maybe it's gone too hard too quick. But
yeah, let me get off this treadmill.
It does feel like a big leap up from the lighthouse, to be fair.
Okay. In the year of 1989, five black and Latino teenagers, each aged between 14 and 16, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, Antron McRae and Youssef Salami were wrongly convicted for the brutal assault and rape of a white female jogger during a late night in Central Park, New York City. The case was marred by coerced confessions, questionable evidence, and a rush to judgment driven by racial bias and media sensationalism. The five young men, later exonerated through DNA evidence in 2002, each spent between 6 and 13 years behind bars for a crime they evidently did not and could not have committed. This horrific incident brought light to the systematic flaws within the criminal justice system and underlined the devastating impact of prejudice as well as the toll it can take on the lives of innocent individuals.
So with this case in particular, what quickly becomes clear is that there are flaws at almost every level. The police, the press, the so-called witnesses, and I think it's summed up very neatly by Jim Dwyer, an author who was at the time of the case a reporter for the New York Times, who had gone to say the following.
Whatever you do in life, you make mistakes. And you either face your mistakes or you don't. I don't think the press faced its mistakes. I don't think the police department faced the truth in what had happened, because the truth of what had happened is almost unbearable. By prosecuting the wrong people in the Central Park jogger case, the true culprit continued to hurt, maim and kill. And they could have had him, but they got stuck with a mistake and they are still invested in that mistake.
So yeah, with this, obviously, I mentioned it's slightly a different one for the series, but I remember being and still being very upset by the West Memphis 3 case. And there are elements of, although a lot of people probably would disagree with this, there are some elements of the Making a Murderer case, particularly if you lean more towards the Brendan Dassey side of things, that I find upsetting. But we've talked about the show a lot on the podcast before. We've talked about the Netflix series Confession Tapes, which again is full of examples of miscarriages of justice that again is really, really difficult to deal with. But this one in particular, it upsets a lot of people to the core. It's heartbreaking. It's very infuriating as well. And ultimately, yeah, it's an absolute travesty what happened to these five young men. But there have been feature-length documentaries made about this case. There's also an entire dramatized series made by Netflix on the case, and we always say it, but this week is a big case indeed. So what we're going to do is provide a bit of a background on the Central Park Five, or the boys themselves, as well as kind of paint a picture of what New York City, particularly Harlem, was like at the time of the incident. New York was considered one of the most criminally volatile cities in the world during the late 1980s and early 1990s, facing the crack cocaine epidemic, gang wars, racial division, police corruption, poverty, and homelessness, as well as having surging crime rates amongst all of that. In 1989, the year that this case hinges on, New York City was the worst city in America for street robberies, and it set a new, at the time, record for murders, with 1,905 people killed in New York across that year, the first one occurring just 41 minutes into the new year. Which is terrifying. It's a huge case, so let's jump into it. What we're going to do is start with a bit of a background on the boys and then move on to New York and then our timeline.
Boys, the boys, boys. Keep that bit in, that bit. I'll slap a bit. Kevin Richardson was born on the 21st of October, 1975. He was the youngest of the five children born to Linda Cuffey and Calvin Richardson. Kevin, like his many siblings, was born and raised in Harlem, New York City. The family had a low-income household, living in a very modest apartment that was surrounded by several housing projects in the West Harlem area. Kevin and his siblings faced the very immediate challenges of growing up in an environment that was riddled with poverty, high crime rates, and had very limited opportunities for young people. Despite their initial difficulties in raising such a large family, Kevin's parents, Linda and Calvin, worked extremely hard to provide for their family, but financial constraints and the lack of stable employment opportunities were a constant presence in their lives. Despite the challenges, Kevin's family was very close-knit, and he shared a strong bond with his siblings. The Richardson siblings would often look out for one another if they encountered any kind of problems in their neighbourhood.
As a young boy, Kevin liked to hang out on the streets of Harlem alongside his many friends, including Raymond Santana and Yusuf Salam, who we'll speak about those two in more detail shortly. Kevin was a very friendly, easygoing child who found it easy to get on with most people. These friendships that Kevin formed were all local to the neighborhood that he lived in and were a natural part of growing up in the, as Tom mentioned, quite a tight-knit community. The boys all came from similar family backgrounds, so of course they understood the struggle of being raised in Harlem at the time. The group of friends spent time together engaging in typical teenage activities like watching TV, hanging out, playing sports, and exploring their city. At just 14 years old, Kevin would be the youngest of the so-called Central Park Five. We're then going to move on now to Antron McRae. So Antron McRae was born on the 14th of January, 1974. And just like Kevin, Antron was born and raised in Harlem, though his family resided in East Harlem rather than West. He was the oldest child of Linda and Bobby McRae Sr., having a younger brother called Bobby Jr. He had a very close relationship with his parents and was heavily protective of his baby brother. Just like Kevin, the McRae family lived in an apartment in a neighborhood that faced many economic struggles and social issues. There was a good deal of homelessness on the streets, and burglaries, armed robberies, and break-ins were not an uncommon occurrence. And Antron is the quite an interesting member of the five boys. He seems more like the... not the outsider, but the other boys seem to at least know one or more of the rest of the group, whereas Antron was kind of, he just knew of them. Antron's early years were marked by an incredibly strong bond with his father, Bobby, who was referred to as someone who was, quote, a fiercely supportive and constantly reassuring, loyal presence in his life. Antron enjoyed spending time with his dad, engaging in activities such as fishing and playing sports, and he looked up to his father as a role model and aspired to be just like him, following in his footsteps. So yeah, Antron's father, I believe he coached one of their little league teams or was some form of sporting coach for the boys. Very much a role model and very much someone that Antron respected and desired to be just like.
Yusuf Salam was born on the 27th of February, 1974. Like the rest of the boys, he also grew up in Harlem and faced the challenges of a neighborhood, grappling with poverty and social difficulties. Yusuf was raised by a single mother, Sharon Salam, who worked as a daycare provider, and his father left the family when he was just a baby. He had a close-knit family that included his siblings and extended relatives. Yusuf was known for his intelligence, curiosity, and eagerness to learn, displaying a strong interest in his education and his future, having an interest in a wide range of subjects at school from a young age. Growing up in Harlem, Yusuf experienced both the joys of the community and the struggles of living in a neighborhood facing crime and inequality. He formed friendships with the other young boys from the area, including Kevin Richardson, but also with Raymond Santana and Corey Wise, who we will discuss shortly. The boys would regularly play sports together and roam around Harlem, as well as exploring the different boroughs of the New York together.
So now we're going to talk about Raymond Santana. Raymond Santana was born on the 7th of September 1974 in New York City, and, just like Antron McRae, grew up in East Harlem, unfortunately facing the very similar struggles growing up in a neighborhood plagued by poverty and crime. Raymond had a passion for art and dreamed of becoming a fashion designer. He was raised by his mother, Rosemary Santana, who worked as a school aide. And his stepfather, I mean, there's speculation about this relationship. Some say he was very close. Some say that the stepfather was very abusive and distant, but it depends which side you lean on. But he did have a close relationship with his family and was the middle child amongst two other siblings. Despite the challenges of, again, a similar environment that the rest of the boys faced, Raymond's family provided a supportive and nurturing environment, instilling the values of resilience and determination. Growing up in Harlem, Raymond experienced the vibrancy of his neighborhood and formed friendships with other local boys, including Kevin Richardson and Yusuf Salam. These connections were a natural part of his childhood, and again, as we mentioned, some of the boys would know one another. Antron McRae seems to have just known of the boys rather than actually hung out with them too much, but again, they would all become sort of friendly towards one another, and again, they'd sort of roam around their city, exploring different parts of New York. And yeah, a note on Harlem as well, because at this point, I feel like all we're doing is talking about poverty and crime around Harlem for the time, but I stayed in Harlem a couple of times in recent years, and I absolutely loved it. I accidentally walked into a wine bar. I thought it was someone's home. It's just a street corner open.
So you thought you were walking into someone's home, but it turned out to be a wine bar.
Well, I was walking.
Oh, sorry. I thought this was someone's house.
No, it was. So basically, it was like a street corner. It had like bifold glass doors. So the corner of the wine bar was exposed, and there's a crowd of people in there. So I sort of just walked in, and then it turned out to be a wine bar, and I had a little wine. But I really liked Harlem. Really liked it. Good location, nice people, easy to get around. Yeah. But although, to be fair, I did stay there sort of 25 years or so after this situation that we're talking about. But yeah, I really liked Harlem. But very different picture back then. And even going back further, so back in the 1920s, 1930s, Harlem was in such a sort of poor way that it was referred to as the slums of New York. And it was considered almost as bad as the Five Points area, which had gained international notoriety in the 1900s as a densely populated, disease-ridden and crime-infested slum for more than 70 years. By some measures, though, the 1970s in particular was considered by historians as, quote, the darkest period in Harlem's history, with some Harlemites, so you've got New Yorkers, you've got Brooklynians, I think that's Brooklyn, Brooklynians, I made that up, with some Harlemites even leaving the area in search of safer streets and better schools in the suburbs, and those who stayed in Harlem would try to contribute to local efforts to revitalize their reputation, clean up the community, despite what some people considered external efforts to prove otherwise. According to an article on humanityinaction.org,
many older Harlem residents remember a time when the city was infested with drugs, plagued by high crime, and preyed upon by unscrupulous slumlords. Poverty, violence, and drugs were the only constants. There's no question that Harlem was a tough place to live before redevelopment in the 1990s revived interest in the neighborhood.
And finally, Corey Wise. Corey was born on the 26th of July, 1972, in New York City. He had an exceptionally difficult upbringing in Harlem, which was consistently disrupted by his family struggles and periods of instability. Corey was raised by his mother, Dolores Wise, who worked as a home health aide, and he had two sisters, Marcy and Vanity. Corey had a complex relationship with his father, who it is alleged abandoned the family on occasion and experienced the dynamics of a tight-knit, yet at times tumultuous and distant household. It's been alleged that he was physically assaulted by his father on a regular basis. Despite the challenges he faced, Corey was known for his friendly nature, loyalty to his friends, and would fiercely defend them should they ever encounter trouble. Corey's childhood, unlike the other four boys, did include brief periods of homelessness due to his mother's financial struggles. He also struggled in school due to an undiagnosed learning disability as well as hearing impairment. This has been considered a possible side effect of physical abuse at home when he was a child. This instability contributed to the challenges he faced as he worked his way through his formative years. At 16 years old, Corey would be the oldest of the so-called Central Park Five.
So yeah, so that's a bit of an overview on The Boys. Obviously, with five backgrounds to cover, we have had to condense where we can, but you do see kind of some very distinct similarities in their upbringings. Obviously, they've all each got kind of slightly different family dynamics, but yeah, they've definitely struggled during the early years in terms of the area that they're based in. As a group, The Boys knew each other from their interactions from within their Harlem community. And as we've mentioned, it seemed like Kevin, Yusuf and Raymond were already relatively good friends with one another, whilst Corey was also friendly with Yusuf. That said, they were not all close friends with Antron. Perhaps he, of the five, knew The Boys the least, but their paths will have crossed due to their shared neighbourhood, age and social circles. And yeah, I believe as well, obviously we talked about Antron's father being very active in the community and very much keen on coaching The Boys' sports, so it's likely they were also perhaps on the same sporting teams or something like that. So before we move into our timeline of events, what we're going to do is just go on to, I know we've talked about Harlem in quite a bit of detail there, but what we're going to go on to do is highlight just how rife with crime New York City was in the late 80s, and how growing up here was absolutely not without its challenges. So New York City, 1989.
Play some like sound effects here.
Hey, I'm walking here.
That's one.
Move out of the way, kid. What's that? What is that? Oh, get away from me.
What could it mean?
Get your slices. Hot dogs.
No, hot dogs?
Hot dog.
That dog should be put down. New York 1989. And much like the upbringings of the Central Park Five, the late 1980s marked a highly tumultuous period for New York City and its almost 16 million residents, with local tensions reaching an all-time high. The landscape was stamped by a highly volatile criminal climate that encompassed a range of challenges, including gang wars, racial division, the war on drugs, as well as the crack cocaine epidemic, growing crime rates, and police corruption. This era saw the city grappling with an unprecedented surge in criminal activities, which left a significant and lasting impact on the city, as well as its reputation and subsequent media portrayals. Gang wars were rampant during the late 1980s, particularly fueled by the crack cocaine epidemic and the vast amounts of money and addiction that this would bring into the city. Various street gangs such as the Bloods, Crips and Latin Kings engaged in fierce territorial battles over drug distribution, resulting in violence and bloodshed on the streets. Many hundreds of innocent people, including women and young children, were killed or trafficked into the gangs. These conflicts exacerbated an already tense environment and contributed to the continued rise in crime rates.
Yeah, a lot of gangs there. Wonder how our gangs would have fared. What was yours again? Yours was like, it'll be great. Mine was, it'll be all right on the night. And yours was,
it'll be even better on the night.
Oh. Racial division further added to the up and down nature of the criminal climate at the time. New York was described as a, quote, under-policed city with crime out of control and a criminal justice system that just wasn't working. Some of the poorer communities of New York, and particularly the communities of non-white ethnic backgrounds, bore the aggressive brunt of law enforcement's crackdown on crime, often tarring any individual with the same brush in terms of gang membership assumption and often experiencing disproportionately aggressive policing and profiling. So essentially, yes, some police officers would assume if you were of a certain ethnic background, you were immediately a member of a gang and therefore committing a crime. This strained relationship between the police and minority communities heightened tensions and eroded trust, further fueling a cycle of crime and mistrust. Reverend Al Sharpton even said in 1987,
"We cannot reform institutional racism or systemic policies if we're not actively engaged. It's not enough to simply complain about injustice. The only way to prevent future injustice is to create the society we would like to see, one where we are all equal under the law. New York is now the capital of racial violence."
As well as this, Yusuf Salaam, one individual of what would later become the Central Park Five, would go on to say,
"You're not the same as everyone else, and nobody ever asks who you are. As black and brown people in New York City, it's as if we were born guilty."
The war on drugs, we mentioned briefly in the crack epidemic, was launched by the Reagan administration in the 1980s and aimed to combat the growing drug trafficking and abuse, not only in New York but across the country. However, its impact on New York City was well known to be deeply problematic. The heavy-handed approach to the police and legal system led to mass arrests, lengthy prison sentences of which disproportionately affected those in marginalised communities. Rather than alleviating the drug problem, this approach often exacerbated the number of criminals on the streets by pushing low-level offenders into a cycle of incarceration. The introduction of crack cocaine brought a new level of drug-related chaos to New York City. the drug was relatively inexpensive and highly addictive, making it easily accessible to a wide range of individuals. The epidemic was particularly destructive in low-income neighbourhoods, where unemployment, poverty and a lack of opportunities intersected with the lure of quick and easy highs. As crack use soared, the city experienced a sharp rise in drug-related crimes such as robberies, burglaries and even homicides, as individuals desperate to feed their addiction turned to increasingly desperate measures. The crack epidemic of the 1980s was a devastating and transformative event that had a profound impact on New York City. This period was characterized by the rapid spread of crack cocaine, a highly addictive and potent form of the drug, throughout the city's neighborhoods. The crack epidemic fueled a surge in violent crime, addiction, and social instability, leaving lasting scars in communities and contributing to the city's overall decline.
The crack epidemic also had a devastating impact on families and communities. Many households were torn apart by addiction, leading to strained relationships, neglect, and shattered homes. Children born to addicted mothers faced a range of health and developmental challenges, perpetuating a cycle of vulnerability. The social fabric of neighborhoods was further eroded as residents lived in constant fear and communities struggled to cope with the crime and chaos that accompanied the epidemic. The crack epidemic not only contributed to a surge in crime rates, but it also exposed deep-seated issues related to poverty, inequality, and the lack of effective social support systems in the city. So yeah, New York at the time, obviously we've talked about the gang wars, the rise in crime rates, the racial division, and now obviously you introduce to that landscape the crack cocaine epidemic, and it's becoming even more violent, even more volatile. There's so much going on, and in the poorer communities or the poorer neighborhoods, these crime rates would rapidly soar. So with all of that in mind, as crime rates continued to surge, New York City became notorious for its high levels of violent crime, including homicides, serial killers, sexually violent crimes, and robberies. I did actually watch as well. I don't know if this was necessarily in the same time period. I recently watched that Times Square killer, the torso killer.
You haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, I tried it a couple of times and it was just a bit slow, but then I actually watched it properly and it's not bad. Not bad, but there was also
torso.
Also, we're doing Netflix a load of favors this week, but there's also the Trial by Media series on Netflix, which I think is fascinating, and that has the Subway Vigilante, and that was a sort of similar time. And then you had the Son of Sam murders in the previous decade. So the fear of crime itself, without everything else that we've just mentioned, was very much present in daily life, contributing to a sense of urban decay and prompting New Yorkers to adopt precautionary measures, often carrying with them concealed weapons, double locking their doors, and traveling in large groups. This environment understandably made people feel even more insecure and on edge about the likelihood of them falling victim to a crime. So amongst these already terrifying challenges, so you've got gang wars going on, you've got drug trafficking and drug addiction going on, you've got poverty, increased crime rates, you've got murderers, you've got everything going on that you could imagine. Amidst this already, instances of police corruption emerged more and more as a troubling reality. Scandals such as the Dirty 30 and the Mullen Commission revealed cases of officers engaging in bribery, drug trafficking, and other illicit activities. This erosion of integrity within the police force further deepened public mistrust and hindered effective law enforcement. So yeah, you've got cases of obviously the racial division, you've got police essentially profiling individuals here completely unfairly, and now the trust between different communities and the police force is at a greater divide than ever before. There's also, and this isn't a Netflix one, so I'm not doing, you know, I'm not on the payroll with Netflix, but there is an amazing documentary film called The 7-5, which is all about police corruption in the 75th precinct of the New York Police Department during the 1980s. And yeah, I watched that years ago. I would highly, highly recommend it. It's something that you just can't believe even happened, that was going on a daily basis if you were a corrupt police officer in New York.
In 1989, New York City was grappling with high crime rates across several of its boroughs, but certain areas were particularly affected by the surge in criminal activities. The boroughs that generally experienced some of the worst crime rates during this time were the Bronx and Brooklyn. The Bronx and the neighborhood of Harlem in particular were known for its elevated levels of violent crime, including homicides, robberies, and assaults. Poverty, social challenges, and lack of economic opportunities contributed to the prevalence of criminal activities in this borough. An extra point to add, although we have obviously focused heavily on New York, it's important to mention that crime rates were on the rise over many other cities and many other countries in the world. The same can be said about the miscarriages of justice. America always gets a lot of stick for this, and that could in part be down to the United States being the subject of more wrongful conviction research than any other country in the world. The results, which are quite troubling, from 1989 to 2017 alone, more than 2,100 people were wrongfully convicted and subsequently released from prison because of evidence of their innocence. So that is a big number. And you can only imagine how many are still locked away or sadly died in prison. So this is also another crazy stat. In the United States, which houses a fifth of the world's prison population, as many as 97% of federal criminal cases are resolved through guilty pleas involving unregulated negotiations between prosecutors and defendants. In 2015, 44% of documented US miscarriages of justice involved cases where the defendant had pleaded guilty.
Yeah, that I couldn't believe that when I saw that. But then you do, obviously, we've seen all the documentaries where there's negotiation tactics, there's coercion, there's a lot of pressure or extended periods of interrogation where, you know what, I'm just going to plead guilty. But 44% of miscarriages of justice are stemming from, in that year, people that just said, I'm guilty, I've done the crime, I've admitted to it. Which is, yeah, it's crazy.
It's usually just the threat of they've got more on you, so they can get more time on you unless you just go on that, yeah. You get less time if you just admit it.
Exactly. Yeah. So Kevin Richardson, who was one individual of what would later become the Central Park Five, said the following.
It needs to be known what we went through. We went to hell and back. We have these scars that nobody sees.
But as well as we mentioned, obviously, that a lot of the focus here has been on New York and Harlem in particular, it's also important to know that instances such as these miscarriages of justice were happening all over the world. A particular flurry of incidents occurred in both Ireland and England as a result of conflict between the British rule of Northern Ireland and the Irish Republican Army. So in the 1970s, there was a series of high-profile cases where the convictions were later recognised as miscarriages of justice. And that includes the Guildford 4 from 1974, the Birmingham 6 from 1975, the Maguire 7 from 1976, and the case of Judith Ward from 1977. And basically, there's so many similarities here. Obviously, there is a heavy political element to this, but these cases featured false confessions, police misconduct, non-disclosure, and issues about the reliability of expert forensic testimony, which again, is very similar to the Central Park Five. And there's also an additional factor which obviously impacted on the decision-making process during both the investigation and the prosecution of these cases, which was their very high public profile and the media attention that it received, as well as the pressure to obtain convictions and restore public confidence, which once again is exactly the same as the case of the Central Park Five. So, New York was a cauldron of crime, poverty, drugs, prejudice, police corruption, and gang wars, and it was on the brink of boiling over during the night of April 19th, 1989. One incident would occur that night, which would later go on to become one of the biggest miscarriages of justice, not only in New York City's history, but the whole of America. So we started our episode with a quote from then New York Times reporter Jim Dwyer, and we're going to leave you with one before moving to our timeline.
I look back at the jogger case and I wish I'd been more sceptical as a journalist. A lot of people didn't do their jobs. Reporters, police, prosecutors, defence lawyers. This was a proxy war being fought and these five young boys were proxies for all kinds of other agendas. And the truth is that reality and justice were not part of it.
And it is here that we move to the timeline of the nightmare in Central Park, the Central Park Five.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com. If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
April 19th, 1989. A large number of young people congregate on the outskirts of Central Park. This includes Raymond Santana, Kevin Richardson, Antron McRae, Yusuf Salam, and Corey Wise. Though they were not necessarily all hanging out together, many of the boys were playing basketball on the streets or having fun with their friends, and Corey was actually at a family dinner. It was a busy evening in Harlem in particular. There were lots of kids playing in the street, and although it was getting late, a public holiday was coming up, and the boys were all in very high spirits. Raymond Santana Sr., Raymond's father, who was watching out on the boys from his home, had noticed the crowds becoming larger and larger, with a number of new faces that he didn't recognize suddenly congregating in the area. Through his fear of things getting out of hand, obviously, as we've mentioned in a lot of detail already, crime, drugs, gangs were rife in the area at the time, he decides to advise some of the boys to go to the park rather than being out on the streets. On this, he said the following.
I told them, you know, too much trouble on the corner. Go to the park. I sent them there that night, so I feel guilty too.
Corey Wise, who was making his way home from eating at a restaurant on 110th Street, bumped into Yusuf, Kevin, and Raymond. Here, they noticed a large group of what they described as good kids and bad kids, some out to have fun and some out to be wilding. And this large crowd that they observed had gathered on 110th and Madison, and within this large group, they noticed Antron McRae. Just past 9 p.m, a group of over 30 teenagers, including the five boys, enter New York City's Central Park. They enter via the entrance at 110th Street and 5th Avenue. The youths plan to participate in an activity known as wilding. According to dictionary.com, wilding is the, quote, practice by a group of young people of going on a random spree of violent criminal activity. On the five boys making their way into the park, Corey, Yusuf, and Kevin said the following.
Walking. Feel the guys horse playing with each other, jumping on each other's back, beat each other up, just horse playing.
We start going towards the main road, and people started throwing rocks at the cars.
A couple that was on a tandem bike, and some kids was harassing them or saying something to them.
It looked like they were trying to pull them off, and the bicyclists kept they held their balance, and they just kept going.
So in this instance, some of the group members had planned to rob and harass members of the general public within the park, and it is not clear if Kevin, Corey, Antron, Yusuf or Raymond were involved in this, though they each remain adamant to date that they were not. It seems as though many different people encountered the boys at night, and in amongst all the chaos, two members of the general public faced significant injuries that resulted in them having to have their injuries tended to at the local hospital. In one retelling of that night's events, members of the Central Park Five recall some of the group terrorising a homeless man. They collectively say,
"A homeless person starts walking across the street and the guys surround him. He had some food. Some of the guys out of the group took his and beat him up. They were beating up this guy really badly and, at some point in time, someone poured out a beer bottle and then smashed him in the head with it."
Soon enough, the police are notified of the group's behaviour. Police officers arrive at the park and begin to search the local area. The group disperse as they see and hear a police car come towards them. Some members of the group hide behind trees, others try and run away from the area as quickly as possible. It has now reached 10 p.m. and after a game of hide and seek with the police, the teens leave Central Park via West 96th Street. Police also decided to leave after the search for the youths was unsuccessful. However, police soon see a group of young men matching the description of the teens they've been searching for. The teens are walking north on Central Park West.
Basically, there were numerous reports to police of young black males causing trouble in Central Park, and obviously that a homeless person had now been physically assaulted as well.
The police attempt to arrest the young men, but petrified, the boys run away, jumping walls to desperately not be arrested by the police. Whilst many of the group are able to escape the police officers, five young men are detained. Two of these men are Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana. And it is important to note at this point, the police are unaware of the attack on Trisha Mailey that we will now go on to discuss.
20th of April 1989. Whilst there had been a group of young men running riot in Central Park, they were not the only ones that people needed to be fearful of that night. At the same time that some of the members of the group were harassing people within Central Park, Trisha Mailey was taking her usual after-work run. Trisha was a keen jogger and would often run this route after work. She put her Walkman on and started her run, just as she had done so time after time before. However, this jog would end in tragedy. Trisha was struck on the back of the head by a tree branch. She was then dragged into a secluded area of grass off the path and then raped and beaten. Trisha would not be discovered for hours after her attack. So obviously everything that Tom's just described, all of this wilding, the attack on the homeless person, the big congregation of people entering the park, that was all sort of 9 p.m. through to the early hours of the following morning. This is now obviously, we're going into kind of the dusk hours here. But she wouldn't be discovered until two men found her at 2 a.m. During the time that Trisha had been alone after her attack, she lost between 75 to 80% of her blood. And when she was found, she was nearly fully naked and she was also convulsing whilst unconscious. After finding Trisha, the men sought help and called an ambulance, where she was then taken to Metropolitan Hospital. And from this point onwards, Trisha would now become known as the Central Park Jogger. And yeah, I mean, she was left in an absolutely unbelievable way here. It's actually remarkable that she survived. When Trisha arrived at the hospital, she was very close to death. She barely had any blood left within her body. From this point onwards, she would be in a coma for 12 days. And due to the severity of her injuries, she was never able to identify her attacker. And she had never been able to remember the attack. Obviously, she got hit by, allegedly hit by a tree branch in the back of the head at night in Central Park. So it's understandable, as well as the impact that she suffered. Even, you know, if you remained conscious, it would be hard to notice what had happened in enough time. She also suffered from hypothermia, serious internal bleeding, severe brain damage, and hemorrhagic shock. Her left eye had been moved from its socket and she faced 21 facial fractures.
After hearing about the attack, police could see no other suspects than those they were already looking out for. By 11 p.m. that night, police had in custody those who they believe had committed the attack, and this was the Central Park Five. These boys were aged between 14 and 16, and during their interrogations, the boys were allegedly threatened and coerced into giving false confessions. Yusuf reflected on the ordeal and said,
"I would hear them beating up Corey Wise in the next room. They would come and look at me and say, 'You realise you're next.' The fear made me feel really like I was not going to be able to make it out."
This pressure weighed on the boys and caused them to admit the horrific attack on Trisha Mailey. Corey Wise was interviewed without the presence of a legal guardian as he was 16 years old. Four of the boys were also videotaped, and this is where they admitted that they had participated in the attack of Trisha Mailey, by either restraining her or touching her in some way. Antron McRae said during his confession,
"What happened when you charged her?
You charged her, and like, you got her on the ground. Everybody started hitting her stuff. And she was on the ground. Everybody stopped and everything. And she got hit. Like, then we got each of, like, I grabbed one arm, So I keep grabbing my arm, and we grab the legs and stuff. And we like, what's the tools getting on? Like, getting on top of her.
I'm sorry, you have
what's to... What's the hands getting on top of her?
Okay, so first it was the black guy, then it was the Puerto Rican guy with the black hood. Then you got on top of her. Did you have your pants down when you did that?
No.
Did you have your fly open?
Yeah, but my penis wasn't in her.
What happened?
I just, like, my penis wasn't in her. I didn't put nothing to her.
Well, when you got on top of her, you got on top of her so that you could have sex with her, right?
Not really. I just doing it so everybody know. I wasn't really doing it.
You said you were just doing it so that everybody what?
Everybody just know I did it.
Yusuf Salam wrote his statement rather than being video recorded. This became a confession, although he vehemently refused to sign it. The boys all gave different stories to the police, yet they all implicated each other. The boys were allegedly told that they would be able to go home if they told the truth. They were also supposedly told that their friends were using their names to implicate them in the attack. And then this caused the boys to use each other's names within their confessions. So yeah, this is one thing I really got from watching the interviews with the boys. They felt as if, you know, I'm not the one that's going to look like a monk here in terms of if they're all going for me, then I'm going to get them. It was the police, I hate this a horrible way, the police played them perfectly in this.
Oh yeah.
Which is not, I'm not bigging up the police at all for what they've done. It's fucking hideous. But in terms of them manipulating the boys and getting them to say exactly what they wanted, they put all of them against one another. So all of them would say things. I mean, imagine saying, you know, and that's the thing is always people struggle to think about with this. It's why would someone admit to doing something if they didn't do it? Well, they'd been in there for about 13 hours. They hadn't had any drink. They hadn't had any food. It's overnight. They're so tired. They've been shouted at, threatened with abuse. Some being hit, like we said, all these things.
Well, Corey as well had an intellectual disability as well that was undiagnosed at the time and a hearing impairment and had no one present with him whilst he was being interrogated as well. And like you said, if the police were trying to get between 20 to 30 black young men that had entered that park and they were only able to get five, but then tell the other four boys, look, name drop and say that Corey said this about you, Kevin said this about you, Antron said this about you, Yusuf, you know, it's easy to see how, as you say, the police would have played them against one each other, like you mentioned. It's,
and as well, these are young lads that, you know, it's, can you imagine being at school, like if and you're kind of where your thinking was then, trying to get out of there, you want to leave, you've been told, if you tell us the truth, you can go home. And it's like, yeah. But the truth, by the way, is going to be you throwing your friends under the bus here in order for you to get out. So these boys were not the only ones that were arrested and taken for questioning regarding this attack. Other members of the young group of men who had been behaving antisocially at the park that night were also questioned, but many of them ended up blaming others. For example, Clarence Thomas told the police about his best friend Corey Wise, and this led to Corey's eventual wrongful imprisonment.
So we then move forward a week to the 27th and 28th of April 1989. The media frenzy that ensued after the attack became public knowledge was horrific. The teens were branded as coming from a, quote, world of crack, welfare, guns, knives, indifference and ignorance, a land with no fathers, to smash, hurt, rob, stomp and rape. The enemies were rich, the enemies were white, as said by Pete Hamill, who was a writer for the New York Post. So yeah, really horrific angle there from the press, but they may as well also have been fed information or leaked information from the police of the time. Obviously there was a corruption was rife at the time as well. Within the course of these 2 days, on the 27th and 28th of April, all of the boys were indicted for their alleged criminal activity. The Central Park Five, as they were dubbed, faced charges for attempted murder, rape, assault and rioting. Four out of the five boys were charged as juveniles, but Corey Wise was charged as an adult. Because of his age, he was sent to Rikers Island Prison. Which, yeah, if you've ever read about Rikers, is not a nice place to have been sent. Rikers Island was a notorious prison. It earned nicknames such as Gladiator School and Torture Island. The prison showed that the city was, quote, unfair to those who became involved in the justice system, and the overwhelming majority who were caught up were black and brown men, as stated by Mr. Corey Johnson at the time, a New York City Council speaker. In 2019, it was announced that the prison would be closed, and its proposed closure is in 2026. And it's a very famous or infamous prison that's had many famous inmates housed there over the time, including Tupac, Sid Vicious, David Berkowitz, and Mark David Chapman. I believe also Lil Wayne has spent some time.
Yeah, that's what it says in the notes, yeah.
Yeah, I just said I believe it. because it was in the notes. Lil Wayne.
You're trying to act as if you have a bit of knowledge in the hip hop game.
Seen him live, bro. Seen him live.
So have I, mate.
Yeah.
We were seeing Blink 182 and he just happened to be supporting. I think you went to get some merch when he was on.
No. Went on a beer run.
The 1st of May 1989, Donald Trump, who was in real estate at the time, pays $85,000 for a four-page article named Bring Back the Death Penalty, Bring Back Our Police, to be printed in the press. In this ad, which calls for the death penalty to be used, he said,
"When they kill, they should be executed for their crimes. Many New York families, white, black, Hispanic and Asian, have had to give up the pleasure of a leisurely stroll in the park at dusk, a Saturday visit to the playground with their families, a bike ride at dawn, or just sitting on their stoops. Giving them up as hostages to a world ruled by the law of the streets, as roving bands of wild criminals roam our neighbourhoods, dispensing their own vicious brand of twisted hatred on whomever they encounter."
Yeah, so $85,000 in today's money is more than that. So the article had a mixed response, to which Trump heavily defended his own opinion. Talking to Larry King a few weeks later after the article released, he said,
"I am strongly in favour of the death penalty. I am also in favour of bringing back police forces that can do something, instead of just turning their back because every quality lawyer that represents people that are in trouble said the first thing they do is start shouting police brutality."
So yeah, at this point, what was Trump famous for in 1989? Probably just the family?
Real estate. He was very much, he was a known public figure. He was on a lot of talk shows and stuff like that. So I think he did still have, I mean, Trump's gone through many different illustrations of himself in terms of money as well. But it does seem to be, it's quite a political move from him, weirdly, way before he was ever to do anything like that. But he's taken a strong stance on it.
Yeah, we just ran it through our spend calculator and 85,000, almost a quarter of a million. So he's either, as you said, using it as a political move, or he has been, I don't know, impacted by this news.
Well, I guess because Central Park, I mean, a lot of things I heard about this case was if that happened somewhere else that wasn't in Central Park, it was just because like Central Park's like the darling of New York. In fact, it happened there was such a kind of horrible thing. And also, I mean, for Trump, obviously, he's with his lot of his real estate, I think, believe in surrounding Central Park as well. He owns some of the buildings, doesn't he? So he probably saw it as a particular stain on the area that he had invested in, and it probably would affect him negatively money-wise as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was kind of more led by that. But I mean, he's always been very outspoken with his beliefs. But yeah, it does seem, I mean, today he would just tweet it, wouldn't he? And have the same impact. Yeah. But then just spend $85,000 on it.
But I just thought with everything that's happened in this timeline, and obviously you've got bloody Donald Trump sort of slinging his oar in there, getting involved basically is what I'm trying to say. And he actually was like, I think they should, bring back the death penalty, which I thought, wow, that's quite a statement, Mr. Trump. So yeah, I thought Trump there's some powerful words from Donald. And I thought, whoa, that's interesting. Really interesting.
Didn't you do this last week?
Did talk a bit about it last week, and that's why I found it even more sort of interesting, especially for sort of
not lazy,
chronological listeners. Yeah, really interesting. Really interesting, yeah. Chuck me in.
Ben Carter's Interesting Facts. Interesting Facts.
Welcome back. I hope everyone's having a rocking August, enjoying themselves so far for the summer months. As this episode came out just a few days after my birthday and the podcast's birthday, the team here at Ben Carter's Interesting Facts thought, you know what, Ben, as it's kind of your
happy
birthday.
Happy 40th, by the way.
Fuck yourself in the face. sorry, that all came out at once. As it's your birthday week, your sort of birthday few days, just go ahead and do whatever you want. So as such, and kind of related to, kind of unrelated to the Central Park Five, but kind of related to last week's case, I'm going to go back to last week's episode, which would be, I thought, quite a pleasing experience if you're a chronological listener on a weekly basis, but otherwise it might irk you somewhat. I'm, of course, going back to last week's mention of Britain's most incompetent executioner, William Calcraft. Here we go. So today we're talking about the poor craft of William Calcraft. Wow, oh wow. So as we explained in our Marianne Cotton episode last week, and spoiler if you haven't checked that one out yet, definitely give it a listen. It's an interesting episode. But William Calcraft,
it's one of the best of the series, I'd say.
it's enjoyable. It's got riddles, it's got jingles, it's got nursery rhymes, it's got spooky bits, like dirty recipes. William Calcraft, he was known as maybe the Ben Carter of the executioner's world. He liked to take his time, often go the scenic or more elaborate route, more often than not, and occasionally he'd bend the rules. And obviously a spoiler alert if you haven't already listened to the Marianne Cotton episode, but Mr. Calcraft's or Calcraft's path would cross with Marianne Cotton's. Initially a cobbler by trade, William is in the history books as the man responsible for hanging the last publicly executed woman and man, respectively, in Britain. So he holds that record in 1868. And William's lasting mark in his 45-year career as an executioner, however, was less of kind of a big historical figure and more of kind of a cloudy sort of laughing stock, really, specifically towards the end of his career.
Laughing so more stocks. Than...
Yes, that's true. Yeah, he was. But, you know, people died. So more than once, William was accused of drinking on the job and showing his nerves on multiple occasions. There was a time when William was set to hang a man simply named O'Connor. And when he set the trapdoor off, the rope braked. The rope broke and left O'Connor alive, needing to be hung a second time. Although, as I mentioned, obviously, William's career went on for 45 years, despite many occurrences of, the rope snapping and people falling. He appears to have been considered a particularly incompetent hangman. So it'd be rubbish at the his consonants and vowels. And frequently having to rush below the scaffold to pull on his victim's legs in order to hasten the death. William preferred a short drop. Method of execution, which basically meant that the rope through the trap door might only be around 3 feet. Which...
That's the problem, surely, because that is not enough to break a neck.
Exactly, it's just under a metre, and it wasn't long enough at all, as Tom said, to break a prisoner's neck, and therefore the deaths were not always instantaneous, typically taking up to a few minutes at a time by strangulation. And some people then started to question, is he really incompetent or is he just torturing these people?
Yeah.
Because, there were some questions there.
Was he a cop? Because he can't be surely a full-time hangman.
He basically was a
cobbler by day.
Cobbler by day, hangman by night, or hangman by sort of Sundays.
Torturer.
People are saying, was he really incompetent or did he just like to torture people? And there's the short drop method as well was particularly controversial. You're supposed to have at least a couple of meters. He only did it with just below one. But also people thought that he was a bit of a showman and did it this way because typically crowds of at least 30,000 people would attend some of his public executions. And he was renowned for his poor taste. So sometimes he would even swing from his victims' legs or climb onto their shoulders in an attempt to break their necks for his baying crowd. In one of the first executions William ever carried out, his victim Thomas Jennings took more than 4 minutes to die.
So don't turn into a physical comedy routine. That's very bizarre.
That was in his younger days. He was a showman, sort of 45 years before his death, before he retired. So he was a bit of a showman 45 years before he retired, but the latter end is quite comical. Another one, the last one I've got here, is that another forgettable day at the office occurred when William was scheduled to execute a criminal by the name of Mr. B.H. Bousfield. However, in the days building up to the execution, William started to receive several threats that he would be, quote, shot on the scaffold if he tried to execute Mr. Bousfield. And this really worried William, who obviously was a nervous guy by nature, liked to drink, and these threats completely unnerved him. So much so that he didn't get any sleep for 4 days before the scheduled execution. Finally, the day came, and after releasing the bolt securing the trap door on which condemned Mr. Bill Bousfield, William then ran off, leaving Mr. Bousfield dangling by his neck. And a few awkward moments went by, and Mr. Bousfield was able to wrap his legs around one of the support legs of the scaffold on the side of the platform, basically countering the hanging. So he was able to keep himself a loose rope. Upon noticing this, William's assistant tried to push him off, but he wouldn't let go. And they then had to get a prison chaplain to go and find William to finish the execution, as he was just hanging by a scaffold at this point and not hanging in the way that they had hoped. They found William cowering in a restroom and forced a petrified William to return to the scaffold, where he then, quote, threw himself around Mr. Bousfield's legs, and by the force of his weight, finally succeeding in breaking his neck and strangling him. William's bungling on this particular execution later became the subject of a popular ballad throughout the late 1800s. There is a reason that William's executioner competitors said, "Mr. William Calcraft came from a family of slow worms. He choked his prisoners to death. He throttled them. But I execute them." So, yeah, there you have it. By no means the excellence of execution. In fact, he kind of frazzled on the scaffold. Incapability at the infirmary. Struggled for them then, but so did William. And yeah, just, we mentioned him last week and I thought I need to have a little bloody look at that. And yeah, very slapstick.
Was he based, where is he based? In Scotland? Because I went to a pub in Edinburgh called The Last Drop. And that was on the, ooh, that was on the kind of square where they would hang people.
He was born in Chelmsford.
Oh, so probably not.
So yeah, probably not. But The Last Drop sounds like a great name for a pub.
It's a good name. Good yeah. name.
Back to the episode.
Ben Carter's interesting facts. Interesting facts.
June 25th, 1990. McRae, Salaam and Santana are imprisoned for the attack on Trisha Mailey. So as we mentioned earlier, only Corey was sentenced as an adult, but all of the remaining members of the Central Park Five were tried as adults but sentenced as juveniles, which was at the time a requirement by law. During the court case, the prosecution repeated that the DNA evidence found on the victim did not match the DNA of any of these young men. One of Trisha's socks contained unidentifiable seminal fluids, and the man that this DNA came from would not be revealed until many years later. Furthermore, the prosecution noted that all of the four boys recorded immediately recanting their confessions, this is obviously with the exception of Corey, after they had finished recording. So, yeah, once they, and it's alleged that there was tampering as when they started recording, when they stopped recording, what was allowed to be omitted onto the audio, what was not shared. In addition to this, all of the confessions were inconsistent with each other. And during each confession, the boys tell a slightly different version of events each time. Furthermore, it seems as though they only add in specific details after they have been shown photographs or have been asked specifically how something happened. And these are very much like, yeah, these questions, when they're asked how something happened, they're very guided questions. So, oh, was it, was, do you think she was
coached?
Yeah, coached, exactly. Yeah, so you see that a lot with, obviously, we'd earlier this series did the Making a Murderer case, and you saw that a lot. They did it very well with Brendan Dassey, and they tried it with Stephen as well. As well as this, there was also a clear trail that was still visible in the grass on Central Park where Trisha Mailey was dragged. I believe it was about 16 inches wide. And this trail was clearly shown in many of the crime scene photos. The trail was only wide enough for one person and did not show signs that would have indicated a gang rape, as the police force had suggested. So yeah, she was dragged through a very narrow patch of grass through into a wooded area. Again, the way that the boys were retelling the events or guided or coached to retell these events absolutely didn't line up with the area that the event actually took place in.
However, we cannot forget that Kevin Richardson did admit that a cut on his face came from the fingernails of Trisha Mailey. But yeah, Kevin in a later interview would talk about how the cut on his face actually happened. It was from a policeman hitting him around the head with a helmet. But obviously the police have coerced him into saying it was actually from a scratch from Trisha. So each of the boys had other people's DNA, including hair and blood, present on their clothes, and whilst DNA testing at the time showed that this hair may have belonged to the Central Park jogger, DNA analysis was not as developed as it is today, and with retrospect we know that this was not in fact Trisha Mailey's hair. Although there was a lack of clear DNA evidence that linked the boys to the scene, eyewitnesses did report seeing some of them walking away from 102nd Street to Transverse Road, which is the area where the Central Park jogger was attacked. More witnesses also reported Kevin Richardson saying, "We just raped somebody," with Raymond Santana laughing that "We made a woman bleed." August 18th, 1990. The jury found all three boys guilty of first-degree assault and first-degree rape in the attack on the female jogger. First-degree robbery and three assault charges for the attack on the male jogger, who was also attacked in the crowd. Second-degree assault for an unrelated attack and first-degree riot. The boys were each sentenced to 5 to 10 years behind bars. So Kevin was also found guilty of first-degree assault and first-degree rape in the attack on the female jogger, first-degree robbery and three assault charges for the attack on a male jogger, second-degree assault for an unrelated attack and first-degree riot, but was only charged with attempted murder in the second degree, and first-degree robbery, rape and sodomy. He received 5 to 10 years behind bars.
22nd of October 1990, so Corey Wise and Kevin Richardson were both brought forward for a second and separate trial. And on the 11th of December 1990, they were both found guilty for the attack on Tricia Maley. Much of the evidence that had been used in the previous case against the remaining three members of the Central Park Five was used in this case. Yet, a new witness was called onto the stand during this trial, and that was Melody Jackson. So, Melody told the court that she had spoken with Corey Wise whilst he was in prison, and that he had told her over the phone that he did not rape the woman, but he did hold her legs down. Corey was friends with Melody's brother. Once again, DNA evidence was used in this trial, and the forensic examiner within the case found that the hair on Kevin Richardson most likely came from Tricia Maley. But again, it's under questionable terms, because he went on to say that he was able to state these opinions to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. The jury found Corey Wise and Kevin Richardson guilty on the 11th of December, and Corey was found guilty for charges of first-degree assault, first-degree sexual abuse, and first-degree riot. He was sentenced to 5 to 15 years. And Richardson was the only one of the five defendants to be convicted of attempted murder of Maley, and he was sentenced to serve 5 to 10 years in a juvenile facility.
And another thing to note here is during the whole of this trial, obviously, it was a big talking point for the press. The media were going crazy over it. And a lot of the families were outside protesting the innocence of their children, of their community members. And one of these people leading the protest was Reverend Al Sharpton, who was a big voice in the black community and was always fighting for the rights of black people being treated unfairly. So lots of the families were outside constantly protesting and wearing T-shirts with the names of their children saying innocent on the front of them.
I think that's a really interesting point as well, because obviously now it's become not only a criminal trial but a very political one. Al Sharpton has become involved, Donald Trump has become involved, all of the family members and friends are now involved. And what's really interesting is I still felt like a lot of the boys and their families felt that maybe there was no chance, based on the fact that they knew they didn't do it, there was no chance that they would actually be convicted. And it's obviously gone completely the way that they had expected it.
Yeah, 100%. Like with anything, if you didn't do something, you don't think you're going to be punished for it, and you think the police will be looking for the person who did commit the crime, but it seemed like the police were happy to rest on their laurels and just assume that they'd done the job and didn't look any further into it. A lot of policemen and a lot of people leading the search, leading the case, would actually go on to, it would help to propel them in throughout their career because it was such a big case that they settled. But we're going to go into a bit more detail about what would turn this around.
So at the sentencing hearing, Yusuf Salam read a poem aloud which said,
"I look upon this legal lynching as a test by my God Allah. I and many others know I told the truth. I would never disrespect my own religion by lying. Give me the max, as sooner or later, the truth will come out."
And Tom McRae would also go on to say,
"I'm not going to let this stop me. I'm going to make it."
And Raymond Santana would say,
"Everyone knows I'm innocent of the crime. I never did it."
So we now move forward to the 12th of June 2002. So yeah, we're going forward 12 years at this point. Convicted. Fucking scared the shit out of me, that.
Well, turn your headphones down. I can hear my own voice now.
Sorry, bro. So we now move forward to the 12th of June 2002. So yeah, 12 years have now passed. Convicted rapist Matthias Reyes, also known as the East Side Slasher, confesses to the attack on Tricia Maley. He said that he had followed her after he had spotted her running in the park. He then ran behind her for a while and kept running from side to side behind her to make sure that no one was following them. When he saw the opportunity, he attacked. So an interesting note here, Matthias Reyes was a serial rapist and his attacks were known to be extremely violent. In the June of 1989, he broke into a pregnant woman's home and raped her whilst her three small children screamed and cried for their mother in the room next door. This woman, named Lourdes Gonzalez, would later lose her life at the hands of Matthias Reyes. So Reyes would be caught by a woman's doorman and neighbour after he attacked another woman. Now, the woman was able to escape during this attack, and she was able to tell her neighbour of the horror that had just been inflicted on her. Reyes followed the woman, but was soon held to the ground. This led to his arrest and DNA evidence being taken from him. This evidence proved that he had attacked others, and as a result, he was sentenced to 33 years to life imprisonment for one murder, five rapes, and two attempted rapes. In 2002, Reyes also confessed that he had acted alone in the attack on Trisha Mailey. He allegedly decided to confess after feeling guilty that the Central Park Five were serving time for a crime that he had committed. And there's audio of this as well. It's absolutely horrific because he kind of says it in quite a sinister way, I feel. But he basically goes on to say that he had met Corey Wise for a second time whilst he was incarcerated in Auburn Prison. The two had previously met whilst serving their sentences and got into a heated argument regarding a television in 1989. Both have adamantly stated that this is the first time they met and that they didn't know each other at the time of the attack in Central Park. Reyes later apologised to him for this argument, and he and Corey began to talk, which apparently led Reyes to remorse. Speaking on his guilt, Reyes said,
"I know it's hard for people to understand, after 12 years, why a person would actually come forward to take responsibility for a crime. I've asked myself that question. At first, I was afraid.
I was petrified.
At first, I was afraid, but I felt it was definitely the right thing to do."
At the time, Corey Wise was the only member of the Central Park Five to still be incarcerated for this crime. It has been reported that during his imprisonment, he eventually stopped going to his parole hearings because he would not admit that he had done the crime. So yeah, obviously, that's a clear sign that he's completely given up all hope and was, you know, he didn't buckle to them saying, look, just tell us you did it. And this is the way that the police then viewed it, or his prison guards viewed it, as he would not admit. It meant that he was not remorseful, and with hindsight, this is devastating. When Mateus Reyes confessed, a judge allowed Wise to be released immediately.
On the 19th of December 2002, DNA evidence proves that Mateus Reyes did attack Trisha Mailey. A sock which contains unknown semen is tested, and a DNA match is found. This proves that he did sexually assault Trisha, but prosecutors did not think that this was solely enough evidence to show that he acted alone. Many pose the theory that both Mateus and the Central Park Five attacked Trisha. Some have questioned the possibility of them attacking separately, and others have a strong belief that Mateus was part of the gang that was attacking random members of the public within the park that night. However, Mateus combated these claims himself. He said that if this was the case, then why did the boys not give his name to the police when they were being interrogated and whilst they were throwing in each other's names into the case? Furthermore, no blood was found on the teenagers. Trisha lost far too much blood for there not to be a drop of evidence on them. So Mateus was also able to tell the police things that only someone there that night would know. He mentioned about taking the keys, trying to think he was going to try and rob the house. So he took the keys from her, and then he threw them away. He was able to remark on the coloured tights that she was wearing when she was jogging. He was basically able to give a description that only someone there on the night would know, or the police would know. And so people thinking maybe he was just claiming it, he knew these things, which was undeniable that he was there that night. Furthermore, a mark on Trisha resembled a link to an item of jewellery that Reyes owned. A medical examiner commented on this.
The patterned injury over the prominence of the victim's left cheekbone is consistent with a left fist blow, striking at an acute angle, partially imprinting the image of approximately half of the prominent parts of Mrs. Reyes's ring on her skin.
So that was the timeline of the Central Park Five. Obviously, we're going to go into a bit of the aftermath and talk a bit more behind what happened whilst the five were serving their sentence, how they were then released, and all of the kind of legacy and cultural impact that this has had in the years since, because there's quite a bit still to go into.
Mateus Reyes could never be actually convicted for the rape of Trisha Mailey. This is because the statute of limitations on the case had run out. And according to Nat Lawman, who would know, the statute of limitations is a time limit for filing criminal charges against someone. After the time limit has passed, the government cannot prosecute, try or punish a person regardless of the evidence against him or her. The case is said to be statute barred. Today, Mateus is still in prison. He was eligible for parole in August of 2022. Trisha Mailey made a name public after she released a book in 2003 titled I Am the Central Park Jogger. The book details how Trisha recovered from the attack and her injuries. It was the release of this book that allowed for the public to finally know the name of the person who had been previously dubbed the Central Park Jogger.
So despite her injuries, and it was an absolutely vicious, horrific attack on her, despite the extent of those injuries, she always remained of the opinion that she did have more than one attacker. But after it was announced that Mateus Reyes had confessed, she said,
"When I heard the news that there was an additional person found whose DNA matched, that wasn't a tremendous surprise. But when he said that he and he alone had done it, that's when some of the turmoil started, wondering, Well, how can that be?
Despite being attacked, Trisha did not let this incident define her. She later became a motivational speaker in 1998 and used her experience to help others. She continued to jog after her attack, and just 3 months after the incident, she joined the Achilles Track Club, and in 1995, she ran the New York Marathon. She married her husband in 1996, and the two are still happily married to this date. She also continues her help with others by working with trauma victims at the hospitals where she was treated. So obviously we talked about Trisha for many years remaining of the opinion that she had more than one attacker. However, then she also stated, obviously, it wasn't a tremendous surprise when Reyes came forward. She had assumed, obviously, that Reyes was just an additional member of those that had attacked her. And despite clear evidence showing this to not be true and that Reyes was the sole attacker, Linda Fairstein continues, despite all of the overwhelming evidence, she continues to uphold the opinion that the methods used against the Central Park Five during their investigation and trial were lawful. And this includes, obviously, all the coerced interrogations, all the kind of coached or guided questioning. Obviously, no advisor or family member or legal representative being present during the interrogations. She even believes that Mateus was involved with the gang, and collectively, all six of them attacked Trisha Mailey. So just for some additional context there, Linda was the lead prosecution for the case. So in those years, New York was incredibly divided, and Linda had a lot of support, though she was extremely harsh in the way that she would accuse the defendants and assert them into this particular case. She obviously remained defiant even after the evidence came forward and the admission from Mateus. She still remained adamant that the five boys were guilty.
In 2003, an investigation was conducted by the New York Police Department into their handling of the case. They found there to be no wrongdoing on their part, which, if you're conducting an investigation into your own department, you probably don't, Despite the new evidence and wrongful convictions, many of the police department still maintained their opinion that their arrests that day were correct. Many still hold the opinion that they arrested sex offenders that day, which I don't know if that's a case of just pigheadedness or if it's a case of they'd rather think it was right rather than live with the fact they've arrested these men, these boys, who lost their childhoods and, you know, are imprisoned. In 2019, a Netflix dramatization of the Central Park Jogger case was released. So the series called When They See Us follows the Central Park Five and was hugely successful. The show ended up receiving 11 awards from award shows in both the UK and America. Although many watched and enjoyed the show, Linda Fairstein did not. She said the show was so full of distortions and falsehoods as to be an outright fabrication. She did end up claiming defamation and taking Netflix to court. She said the show portrayed her as a racist, unethical villain. Hashtag cancel Linda Fairstein was created after the show was released. So she's the person I mentioned earlier as well. Her career, this gave her a massive boost back in the day when she was finally able to settle the case. But now it seems like the crows are coming to roost. That's not even an expression, but I'm sticking with it. The pigeons are coming back to the nest, smugly. After the release of the series When They See Us, Donald Trump was asked if he would apologise to the young men who were charged for the rape of Trisha Mailey. He replied back with, "If you look at Linda Fairstein and if you look at some of the prosecutors, they think that the city should never have settled that case, so we'll leave it at that." Trump never wants to admit when he's wrong, really, is he?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he usually doubles down more often than backing down, which is a scary move sometimes to make. Linda as well, Linda Fairstein. So she obviously made all these comments about Netflix, sued them for defamation. She also tried to write, I mean, she's gone on to become quite a successful author regardless, but she did try to write numerous books about the case of the Central Park Five, but multiple publishers dropped her around the same time that she took Netflix to court. So I don't know. In the documentaries I've seen, she comes across as very stern, but very, she was using politics and race almost as trying to use it as evidence in this case.
It was a bubbling cauldron at the time, wasn't it? And she happened to be the witch dancing around it.
That's bloody love that.
Dan wasn't even listening.
So obviously a very highly pivotal moment in this case was when Mateus Reyes came forward, and later DNA advances came forward as well in this case. And after lengthy multiple appeals, Raymond Santana was finally released in 1995, Antron McRae in 1996, and Yusuf Salam, as well as Kevin Richardson, in 1997. Unfortunately, Corey Wise had to wait another 5 years until he was released in August of 2002. Today, the Central Park Five are still majorly affected by the wrongful conviction that faced them for so many years, and clearly the courts agreed. It took them over a decade, but in 2014, they received a settlement of $41 million, with Corey receiving $12 million of that. On this settlement, Corey said the following.
You can forgive, but you won't forget. You won't forget what you lost. No money can bring that time back. No money can bring the life that was missing or the time that was taken away.
Yeah, because that's the horrible thing. For five young men, it's not just many, many years. So they've all served between sort of 6 to 13 years each. It's super, super important formative years of your life. Your adolescence gone.
If you look at yourself when you're 15 to now,
yep.
And you think if you had that time in jail, you just learn a completely different way of life, not know how to interact, not know how to socialise. It's horrible. The documentary has really painted that picture really clearly, just in terms of like how they're all still suffering. And it's not a case of, you start thinking, yeah. 12 million for that long. How long would I do? It's like, it's not a joke. They lost their childhood. They lost their innocence. Yeah. Even when some of them were released, they were, applying for jobs and unable to get them because they're on the sex offenders list and whatnot. It was, yeah.
Yeah. So also Raymond Santana Sr., Raymond's father, even decades on from this, still has so much trauma because obviously he was the one that said, boys, go from the corner, go to the park. It'll be safer there. Where obviously, how could he have known what was later to happen that night? But it took many, many years, but eventually the boys were cleared of their charges. They didn't have to go through a kind of West Memphis 3 sort of deal. And they didn't have to obviously go ahead and take an alpha plea like the West Memphis 3 did.
And as we're saying, with the people, with the boys coming out, finding it hard to acclimatize, Raymond Santana actually ended up going back to prison following drug related charges. He said he was sitting around, he couldn't get a job. He felt like it was a waste of space. So the only way he thought he could make money was basically starting to deal drugs, and he eventually would be caught and sent to prison. And his prison time was a lot longer than it would have been because obviously he'd already served time in prison, so they actually put him in for a bit longer. So when the boys were cleared and had their names cleared, he was actually in prison for this drug charge. But then because essentially the first crime they were cleared of, his time was knocked down and he'd actually already served that time. So he wasn't actually free at the time when the names were cleared. It just goes to show there's always a ripple effect with all these things that go on. So a little bit of a brighter ending here when we talk about where the guys are today. Today, Kevin Richardson now has a high school diploma and has since married and has become a father. Antron McRae now lives in Atlanta with his children. Raymond Santana now owns his own clothing company named Park Madison NYC. He has also had a daughter. Corey Wise founded the Corey Wise Innocence Project. The project gives free of charge legal service to those who state that they have been wrongfully convicted. Yusuf Salam has had 10 children, has become a motivational speaker and author. Yes, luckily the men are all out now. And they're living the lives that they've claimed back. So so that is the case of the Central Park Five. But we haven't finished the episode. So, I thought there's a lot of talk about the Central Park. I think all of us have visited Central Park. Am I right? You guys have been there before?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Three times.
Bloody. Twice.
I think I might have been three, but who knows? But I thought, obviously, this is a very sad story connected to the Central Park. And I thought maybe a couple of quirky tales about Central Park just to kind of lighten the mood of Central Park. So it's time for TTs. Get them out, Dan.
Mammy!
Tommy's trivia! That's terrific! So yes, so a few little, I always say, is it tidbits?
Yeah.
I've always said titbits. If you listen back to any previous episode, I definitely would say titbits. But yeah, a few little tidbits about Central
Park. It is titbits.
Is it?
Oh. Yeah.
Titbits.
What does that even mean?
Where does that come from?
A small and particularly interesting item of gossip or information.
Oh, I'm going to show you a titbit.
Tommy's titbits.
Yeah, no, I don't like that.
I love it.
That's good, actually. I might change the jingle.
It's Tommy's trivia, mate.
Tommy's titbits. Titific.
No. But yes, anyway, so I've got
titbits!
Three little segments here. The first one I've called Cannons Away. So there was an old ship cannon which was stored in a place called the Ramble Shed in Central Park. And this cannon was previously used but had been retired for more than two centuries. But in 2013, when a park crew gave it a good old cleaning the cannon, they discovered that it was ready for battle.
and it was containing a cannonball and nearly 2 pounds of active gunpowder.
Wow.
Kaboom.
Which is, you would have thought you would check, like, early on, you'd check that, right? Like, oh, if I was there, I'd probably show off my powers. I probably would just light it and just aim it at someone and go, hey. Yeah.
You love a bit of wilding, don't you?
I do love a bit of wilding. I like rewilding. This one, I think, would definitely pique Dan's interest. I'm not sure if you've... I don't know if either of you've seen... Have you seen Oppenheimer yet?
No.
Okay. Well, the Manhattan Project. Apparently, there's a huge underground complex under Central Park. And apparently, it was utilized as part of the Manhattan Project. For those of you that don't know, the Manhattan Project was a military operation dedicated to the construction of the nuclear weapons, and it's heavily shrouded in mystery. So there's lots of conspiracy theories about the use of the thing that they believe is to be under Central Park, and, you know, they mentioned aliens and whatnot. Another theory states there's a complex under Central Park equipped with over 60 miles of roads, an underground lake, which I've never really understood the purpose of an underground lake, and one of the largest telephone exchanges in the United States. I'll end on the underground lake. But yeah, the underground lake is a mysterious one in my eyes. And the other thing I thought was interesting, there's a few people that have been spotted or animals spotted in Central Park. There was an alligator, but turns out to be actually a South American caiman. Couldn't believe his luck. And Susie Grunt, a 15-year-old girl that occupied a cave. She lived in there in 1987. I don't know if she was actually called Grunt or if it's just noise that she'd make for communication. And there was an invasive species of frankenfish, which is a snake-headed fish that inhabited the waters there in 2013. And the last one, there was a 3-foot-tall, not-so-big Bigfoot spotted in 1997.
These frankenfish are terrifying-looking.
Frankenfish.
The snakes of the water, truly.
Ooh, I don't like snakes of water. Keep them in the underground lake, if you ask me. But a 3-foot Bigfoot, that's nice. That's cute. That's cute. But yeah, I mean, that's a very cluster bomb of random things about Central Park. It wasn't very formulated. So apologies there. I think I've let my TTs down.
No need to apologise, Tom. I thought it was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Would have been cool if you dived deeper in about that, you know, that underground lake. That would have been...
But then that's just a theory that people are saying they believe there to be underground cities and lakes and stuff. And I'm like,
yeah.
But yeah, that is that. And that is this week's case. I mean, Dan, pick a winner for that. I'm more than happy to concede there.
Well, although it would have been suited much better for last week's case, I'm going to go with Ben for this week. So Ben, you get a point. Well done.
Fair. Oh,
thank you, sir. I'm just Googling underground lakes, Tom. And some of these photos, I mean, it's like a cave lake, I would imagine.
Cave lake.
They do look...
Frankenfish.
I tried to find a Central Park cave lake, underground lake, but they're bloody beautiful, some of these cave lakes.
Well, there you go. Why not give it a little Google? But Dan, I mean, I haven't figured it out, and I'm on the edge of my seat wanting to know the riddle.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about this because, like I said, it's not necessarily true crime related. It's not true crime related.
That's fine.
I might have to rethink that because this is far too vague. But the riddle was 2 in a corner, 1 in a room, 0 in a house, but 1 in a shelter. What am I? Any guesses?
2 in the corner.
I've got an idea, but I could be wrong. I've tried to think of...
It's in a typical riddle fashion. Just think about it.
Is it a piece of post?
Oh.
Like a letter or an envelope or something.
Two in a
like
corner.
That. Stamp.
One in a room.
Oh.
0 in a house, but 1 in a shelter.
Yeah.
He's got it. This is sick content. What is it?
R.
Fucking smashed it. The letter R.
Oh, letter.
Well done, Tom. Very impressive. Because I thought that is very hard, actually.
Well, yeah, I was... Until you did the little bit of a gimme, I didn't have it at all.
Yeah. Well done.
Dan's riddle, sly and mischievous grin. Twist and turn and mind game to win. Puzzles are plenty, a chuckle or two. A laugh and thought, we find our clue. Riddles!
But yes, thank you so much, guys, for listening. We hope you guys enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with a brand new case. Ben, have you got a little sneaky clue for next week's case?
Cool, blimey. Yeah, of course I have. Next week, here's my clue. Next week... You might want to hide half your bag of your favourite crisps.
There you go. I mean, yeah, good luck with that. And yes, guys, if you listen to us on Spotify or on iTunes, please leave us a cheeky little review. It helps more than you'll ever know. Thank you so much for your support.
and we're excited to be back next week. And we're getting through this season, but we've been a few people saying it's been the favourite season, which you do love to hear.
You love that, don't you? You love that. If you want to go a little step further and help us out, it would be amazing if you could share us on your social medias, pop us in your Insta story, tweet about us. You can do threads, I believe, about us as well, or TikToks, whatever you want to do.
Threads.
Just chuck us out there and tell your friends about us. We'd really, really appreciate it. And if you just can't wait until next week's episode, then at the time of recording, 125 minisodes that are really hour long, mostly at this point. And we have our own private RSS feed, so you can take them with you. So just head over to icmap.co.uk, take a look. It is our birthday, and producer Dan has slashed prices in half to celebrate us turning my favourite number 3. Happy birthday, one and
happy
all.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, one and all. And yes, guys, like we always say,
we say this all the time,
keep doing what you're doing.
Unless it's double down in and Trumpy Trumping. I'm playing it very safe this week.
Yeah, that's fair. Always check your cannons. Always check them.
Yeah, dust them off.
If they're going to be decoration, check them before. That's me. All right.
Have a lovely week.
Until next time. Toopip.
See ya.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.